Hello and welcome back to Ethereum Audible, Ethereum in Depth. This is where I read the best and most in-depth papers from the Web3 and crypto ecosystem. We're wrapping up 3 weeks of reading Lynn Alden's Lightning Network take with a brief interlude about Tornado Cash and the repercussions of censorship in Ethereum. And today we're going to be doing something a little bit different. Today we're going to be going back in time to one of the seminal papers of crypto. The seminal paper of crypto, the Bitcoin white paper. There are two episodes for this one episode. This one, which has a full read-through with explanation. And if you just want the read-through without explanation, there's another podcast in your feed with just a read-through of the Bitcoin white paper, sans explanation, with nothing additional added. Both of these are from the Alp Audio book clubs, where in Alp Audio, which is my other audio education initiative, where you can find in-depth courses and book clubs about different books. And one of those book clubs is about the Bitcoin white paper. So that is what you're going to be hearing today. If there are references to resources or links or things like that, you can find those in the Alp Audio app, not in the podcast feed. So without further ado, enjoy this Alp Audio book club and read through of the Bitcoin white paper. Welcome to an Alp book club, where we dive into books we love and share what they're about and our learnings with you. Today we're going to be reading a white paper, an article, a research paper that is one of the seminal pieces of writing in the past decade, the Bitcoin white paper. I first read it in 2016 or 2017 in the beginning of one of the Bitcoin bull markets and was just blown away by how succinct it is, how well-written, how approachable it is to the general public. And despite that, there are so many people who've never read it, and it's short, it's only 9 pages, including references, and it's written to be understood and read almost by every layperson out there. And so I think this is a core paper that everyone who cares about the economy should understand and have read at least once. And in today's book club, we're going to be reading through it, start to finish, barring one page at the end, which just has a lot of calculations in it, but isn't crucial for understanding the core concepts of the Bitcoin white paper. Throughout the reading, there are some charts that you'll find in the book club's resources for you to review later, but this is understandable even without those charts. At the end, I'll give a short recap and explanation on parts that I found particularly interesting, and you can find a link to that in the book club chapters. So without further ado, let's dive into the Bitcoin white paper by Satoshi Nakamoto. Abstract: a purely peer-to-peer version of electronic cash would allow online payments to be sent directly from one party to another without going through a financial institution. Digital signatures provide part of the solution, but the main benefits are lost if a trusted third party is still required to prevent double spending. We propose a solution to the double spending problem using a peer-to-peer network. The network timestamps transactions by hashing them into an ongoing chain of hash-based proof of work, forming a record that cannot be changed without redoing the proof of work. The longest chain not only serves as proof of the sequence of events witnessed, but proof that it came from the largest pool of CPU power. As long as a majority of CPU power is controlled by nodes that are not cooperating to attack the network, they'll generate the longest chain and outpace attackers. The network itself requires minimal structure. messages are broadcast on a best effort basis, and nodes can leave and rejoin the network at will, accepting the longest proof of work chain as proof of what happened while they were gone. 1. Introduction. Commerce on the internet has come to rely almost exclusively on financial institutions serving as trusted third parties to process electronic payments. While the system works well enough for most transactions, it still suffers from the inherent weaknesses of the trust-based model. Completely non-reversible transactions are not really possible, since financial institutions cannot avoid mediating disputes. The cost of mediation increases transaction costs, limiting the minimum practical transaction size and cutting off the possibility for small, casual transactions. And there is a broader cost in the loss of ability to make non-reversible payments for non-reversible services. With the possibility of reversal, the need for trust spreads. Merchants must be wary of their customers, hassling them for more information than they would otherwise need. A certain percentage of fraud is accepted as unavoidable. These costs and payment uncertainties can be avoided in person by using physical currency, but no mechanism exists to make payments over a communication channel without a trusted party. What is needed is an electronic payment system based on cryptographic proof instead of trust, allowing any two willing parties to transact directly with each other without the need for a trusted third party. Transactions that are computationally impractical to reverse would protect sellers from fraud, and routine escrow mechanisms could easily be implemented to protect buyers. In this paper, we propose a solution to the double spending problem using a peer-to-peer distributed timestamp server to generate computational proof of the chronological order of transactions. The system is secure as long as honest nodes collectively control more CPU power than any cooperating group of attacker nodes. I want to stop and just break down that sentence, because that sentence we just went over is the core of the Bitcoin protocol. I'll read it again and then break it down. Quote, "We propose a solution to the double spending problem using a peer-to-peer distributed timestamp server to generate computational proof of the chronological order of transactions." End quote. What's being proposed here is a solution to a problem that's prevalent in electronic payments, and that is the double spending problem. And basically, the double spending problem is, if I have cash and I go to the flower shop to buy some flowers, I buy flowers and give them an $100 bill. I can't go and spend that $100 bill again because I've physically given it over. But in an electronic system, that's more complicated. For example, if you only have $100 in your credit card accounts and you go to one florist and you pay for those flowers with your credit card, even though you've spent those $100, you only get debited from your account at the end of the month or at the 10th of the next month, whatever date you have. And so you could go into another flower shop and spend those same $100. And that would be double spending the same $100. If at the end of the month you haven't increased the balance in your account to $200, well, you have two flower bouquets at home. You're really happy. One of those florists is actually, in theory, out $100. And so what happens in the financial system that we all live in, it's not the florists who are out of $100, it's actually the credit card company. They then charge you interest on that debt, but you've actually just double spent money you don't have. And the credit card company in the middle is taking that risk. The proposal of the Bitcoin white paper is a solution where there is no need for that credit card company in the middle that takes that risk, that charges those fees. And even without that credit card company, there's a solution to the double spending problem. And the solution they're proposing is using, again, to quote, a peer-to-peer, as in person-to-person, friend-to-friend, there's no institution in the middle, it's just a network of peers, distributed timestamp server, as in a server, a computer, a database that's distributed across those peers, where there is a timestamp to each transaction, so that if I went to florist number one and spent $100 at 10.02 p.m., then I couldn't go into florist number two and 10.04 p.m. because there's a timestamp to my transaction. And we trust that timestamp because there is, again, to quote, a computational proof of the chronological order of transactions, as in there is some kind of proof, and we'll get into this further on in the white paper, that those transactions happened at the time that we stated, that I really, at 10.02, bought those flowers with my $100. And so that is what the Bitcoin white paper introduces, a solution to the double spending problem using a peer-to-peer distributed timestamp server to generate computational proof of the chronological order of transactions. Two, transactions. We define an electronic coin as a chain of digital signatures. And here again, I'd like to pause for a second and just contemplate this sentence. We define an electronic coin as a chain of digital signatures. Just think for a second about what money means. I grew up in a cash-based system where the central bank printed bills, and those bills were worth something because everyone accepted them. But really, what a bill is a physical signature of ownership of money. I'll say that again. What a bill is a physical signature of ownership of money. If I have a bill isn't really worth $100. It's just a piece of paper. But what it is a signature, a warrant, a guarantee that someone will accept that piece of paper for that amount of money. And so an electronic coin is just the same thing, but in the digital world. And so an electronic coin, when it's defined the same way, as a chain of digital signatures, as in proof that this coin, this asset, belongs to you or belongs to Bob. Now, the way to make sure that we know who owns what coin in a world where there is no physical bill is based on the next sentence, which is, quote, each owner transfers the coin to the next by digitally signing a hash of the previous transaction and the public key of the next owner, and adding these to the end of the coin. And what this long sentence means is that by using a cryptographic system called a hash, we are signing the coin and giving it to someone else. And just like in a world we would give over the bill, and once someone else has that bill, they have it, we can't dispute that fact. Well, in the digital world, that is done by using a hash. And a hash is a mathematical function that's used in cryptography. And I'll put a link in the resources for you to dive in deeper to it. But essentially what it is a way to digitally verify a signature. When you use a password to log into a website, in the back end, there's a hash function. When you send an email to someone else, in the back end, there's a hash function. Hash functions are used everywhere over the internet to verify security and identity. Each owner transfers the coin to the next by digitally signing a hash of the previous transaction and the public key of the next owner and adding these to the end of the coin. A payee can verify the signatures to verify the chain of ownership. And here there is a diagram that you'll find in the course resources. The problem, of course, is the payee can't verify that one of the owners did not double spend the coin. A common solution is to introduce a trusted central authority, or mint, that checks every transaction for double spending. After each transaction, the coin must be returned to the mint to issue a new coin, and only coins issued directly from the mint are trusted not to be double spent. The problem with this solution is that the fate of the entire money system depends on the company running the mint, with every transaction having to go through them, just like a bank. We need a way for the payee to know that the previous owner did not sign any earlier transactions. For our purposes, the earliest transaction is the one that counts, so we don't care about later attempts to double spend. The only way to confirm the absence of a transaction is to be aware of all transactions. In the mint-based model, the mint was aware of all transactions and decided which arrived first. To accomplish this without a trusted party, transactions must be publicly announced, and we need a system for participants to agree on a single history of the order in which they were received. The payee needs proof that at the time of each transaction, the majority of nodes agreed it was the first received. So the section we just heard is really outlining the Flores situation that I was talking about previously, where you need a time-stamped ledger, a time-stamped database that tracks all of the different transactions so that no one can double spend digitally. And the way the paper proposes this is that to do this without a trusted party, as in without that credit card company in the middle or a bank, transactions must be publicly announced, as in you have to go and shout from the rooftops that you went in to Bob's florist and you bought flowers. And then, once you publicly announce that to the entire world, we need a system for participants to agree on a single history of the order in which they were received. As in, it's not enough for you to shout it out to the world, but if you shout it out, well, only people in 100 or 200 meters will hear you. What about people across the ocean? And so you need a way for them to also hear it and for everyone to agree that, yeah, you did go into Bob's florist shop and you did spend $100 and you did spend them at 10:02 p.m. and not at 10:15. And so for a electronic coin to work, the digital signature, the passage of ownership from one person to another, has to include all of those elements. Three, timestamp server. The solution we propose begins with a timestamp server. A timestamp server works by taking a hash of a block of items to be timestamped and widely publishing the hash, such as in a newspaper or Usenet post. The timestamp proves that the data must have existed at the time, obviously, in order to get into the hash. Each timestamp includes the previous timestamp in its hash, forming a chain, with each additional timestamp reinforcing the ones before it. And so basically, what we have here is a chain. This is where the blockchain gets its name. You have transactions, you gather them together, and you give them a hash with a timestamp. That hash and timestamp connects to the previous block of transactions. The next block of transactions will connect to this block of transactions. So that's what it means when the white paper says each timestamp includes the previous timestamps in its hash, forming a chain, with each additional timestamp reinforcing the ones before it. The longer the chain, the longer the transactions, you're giving credence to the transactions that happened previously, because each block is built on everything that came before it. And so the timestamp element connecting these transactions sequentially through time is what gives you a chain of connected blocks, i.e. a blockchain. Four, proof of work. To implement a distributed timestamp server on a peer-to-peer basis, we will need to use a proof-of-work system similar to Adam Back's Hashcash, rather than newspaper or Usenet posts. The proof-of-work involves scanning for a value that when hashed, such as with SHA-256, the hash begins with a number of 0 bits. The average work required is exponential in the number of 0 bits required and can be verified by executing a single hash. For our timestamp network, we implement the proof of work by incrementing a nonce in the block until a value is found that gives the block's hash the required 0 bits. Once the CPU effort has been expended to make it satisfy the proof of work, the block cannot be changed without redoing the work. As later blocks are chained after it, the work to change the block would include redoing all the blocks after it. 5. I want to give color on proof of work and the challenge it's coming to overcome. If we go back to our challenge of double spending at the florist shop, we said that what's needed is a peer-to-peer system that timestamps when a transaction was made in an irrevocable way so that the rest of the world can't refute that. And the example I gave was if you go and stand at the top of Bob's Florist and you scream out, "Everyone, hello world, at 10:02 p.m., I bought $100 worth of flowers." The challenge becomes, why does the rest of the world believe you and not Alice? Alice comes out of her florist shop and says, hey, you spent $100 with me yesterday at 10 in the morning. How do we know who's telling the truth? And if you recall what we said, that the Bitcoin protocol is a distributed ledger, as in a database, a notebook where people keep track of who spent what with whom and when publicly, then in theory, we should be able to just open the ledger and take a look. And this is where proof of work is critical, because there's one ledger, but what prevents anyone from going in and just changing it? Maybe you really did go in and spend that money with Bob, but Alice wants to go back in time and she opens the ledger and she goes backwards to 10 a.m. yesterday morning and she just changes the ledger. What's to prevent her from doing that? And the answer is proof of work. And proof of work very simply states that to go and change the blockchain, to go and change a block back in time, there's a certain amount of computational work that you have to do. This comes down to, again, cryptography and math, but at its core, proof of work for Bitcoin is built up of solving a mathematical problem that is very, very simple, but hard to do. And so the only way to solve the problem is by computational brute force. And what I mean by that is just by running the calculation over and over again until you find a solution. A good example of this kind of problem is the search for prime numbers. So a prime number is a number that can only be divided by itself and the number 1. To find a prime number, there's actually no way to find the next prime number except for counting up. 1 would be a prime number because it is divided by itself and number 1. The next number after 1 is 2, and we ask, is 2 a prime number? And we say 2 divides by 2, and it divides by 1, so it's a prime number. The next number after 2 is 3. 3 divides by itself, 3, and it divides by 1, great. It doesn't divide by 2, so it is a prime number. Is 4 a prime number? What's the next prime number after 3? We could guess, but really we'd have to count, and we'd say 4 is not a prime number because it divides by 2. 5 would be our next guess, and 5 actually is a prime number because it doesn't divide by 2, 3, or 4, only by 5 and by 1. As you can see, finding the next prime number is dependent on simply counting plus 1 and then checking. Does it divide by 1 and by itself, or does it divide by another number? To find the next prime number, there's no way to shortcut it. You just have to count plus 1. But, and this is super cool, once you've found a prime number, it's really easy to verify if that's true. And while the examples I gave were really small, once you get to prime numbers in the tens of digits, it's really hard to find the next prime number. And you have to count up sometimes millions of numbers to find the next one. But once you find it, you can easily verify that you actually found it. And that's a key to the kind of computational proof of work problem that the white paper proposes. A problem that is computationally intensive, but once you find it, can easily be verifiable that it's correct. And so that's what proof of work is based on. It's not actually finding prime numbers, but it's a similar computational problem in its elements that it's computationally intensive. There's no shortcut to it, but once you find it, it's easily to prove that you've actually found the right solution. And again, this matters to the protocol because this is how you maintain the sanctity, the trust in the ledger, in that notebook of transactions. To amend transactions to the notebook, you have to actually do this computational power, and it's not so easily done. And so to go back in time, if Alice wanted to change the ledger, she would actually have to go back to yesterday morning and then try and fix the numbers, quote unquote, by solving that proof of work enough times so that she could convince everyone else that her ledger is true. And that's computationally very intense. And dealing with those kinds of actors, people who want to attack the blockchain to change the numbers, is what's called a 51% attack. It's the main risk to this distributed ledger. The proof of work also solves the problem of determining representation in majority decision making. If the majority were based on one IP address, one vote, it could be subverted by anyone able to allocate many IPs. Proof of work is essentially one CPU, one vote. The majority decision is represented by the longest chain, which has the greatest proof of work effort invested in it. If a majority of CPU power is controlled by honest nodes, the honest chain will grow the fastest and outpace any competing chains. To modify a past block, an attacker would have to redo the proof of work of the block and all blocks after it, and then catch up with and surpass the work of the honest nodes. We will show later that the probability of a slower attacker catching up diminishes exponentially as subsequent blocks are added. To compensate for increasing hardware speed and varying interest in running nodes over time, the proof-of-work difficulty is determined by a moving average, targeting an average number of blocks per hour. If they're generated too fast, the difficulty increases. 5. Network. The steps to run the network are as follows. 1. New transactions are broadcast to all nodes. 2. Each node collects new transactions into a block. 3. Each node works on finding a difficult proof of work for its block. 4. When a node finds a proof of work, it broadcasts the block to all nodes. 5. Nodes accept the block only if all transactions in it are valid and not already spent. 6. Nodes express their acceptance of the block by working on creating the next block in the chain using the hash of the accepted block as the previous hash. Let's just review the steps to run the network. And the first one is that new transactions are broadcast to all nodes. And nodes are just points in the network. So I could be a node, you could be a node. If we're running the software that keeps track of the Bitcoin ledger, we are each nodes. New transactions, as in when you go into Bob's florist shop and you give him $100, you then broadcast that to all the nodes just by standing on the rooftop and screaming it. And in the Bitcoin network, that happens with software. The next step is each node collects new transactions into a block. What that means is you take 10, 15, 20 transactions that are broadcast to you. You bought at the florist, I bought some juice, John spent money to Mary, all of these different transactions. And we take those transactions and just collect them together into a block of transactions, 10, 15, 20 transactions. What happens next is those transactions aren't part of the official ledger until a block of those transactions gets amended to the blockchain. And that happens by solving the proof of work. And so every node in the network tries solving the proof of work, tries solving that computational problem that shows that, yes, this is going to be a valid block. And that takes time. In the Bitcoin network today, it's on average 10 minutes. And when a node finds that proof of work, it sends out a message to all of the rest of the nodes saying, hey, I found it. I found it first. I solved the puzzle. And you can see that it's correct because once I've solved a problem, remember, you can easily verify that the solution is actually correct. The node that solves the problem puts all of the transactions, puts them into that block, which is correct because the proof of work is solved. And then you check that all the transactions are also correct, as in the $100 you spent at the florist are really yours to spend. And we do that by verifying the hash, that digital signature of the transaction. And if all of the transactions that we collected are valid and the block is valid, we broadcast that to the network. And the network sees that everything is valid and that it's a valid block because of the proof of work. And everyone accepts it, stores it in their ledger of transactions. Nodes always consider the longest chain to be the correct one and will keep working on extending it. If two nodes broadcast different versions of the next block simultaneously, some nodes may receive one or the other first. In that case, they work on the first one they received, but save the other branch in case it becomes longer. The tie will be broken when the next proof of work is found and one branch becomes longer. The nodes that were working on the other branch will then switch to the longer one. New transaction broadcasts do not necessarily need to reach all nodes. As long as they reach many nodes, they will get into a block before long. Block broadcasts are also tolerant of dropped messages. If a node does not receive a block, it will request it when it receives the next block and realizes it missed one. 6. Incentive. By convention, the first transaction in a block is a special transaction that starts a new coin owned by the creator of the block. This adds an incentive for nodes to support the network and provides a way to initially distribute coins into circulation, since there is no central authority to issue them. The steady addition of a constant of amount of new coins is analogous to gold miners expending resources to add gold to circulation. In our case, it is CPU time and electricity that is expended. The incentive can also be funded with transaction fees. If the output value of a transaction is less than its input value, the difference is a transaction fee that is added to the incentive value of the block containing the transaction. Once a predetermined number of coins have entered circulation, the incentive can transition entirely to transaction fees and be completely inflation-free. The incentive may help encourage nodes to stay honest. If a greedy attacker is able to assemble more CPU power than all the honest nodes, he would have to choose between using it to defraud people by stealing back his payments or using it to generate new coins. He ought to find it more profitable to play by the rules, such rules that favor him with more new coins than everyone else combined, than to undermine the system and the validity of his own wealth. Section 6 is all about incentives. In the section on proof of work, we spoke about how hard it is, how computationally intensive it is to find the solution to the math problem that solves the proof of work. And we said that we need that so that the network can stay secure, so that you can validate that a block is real, that all of those transactions bundled into that block are valid, which leads to the question of, well, why should anyone spend so much time and effort to secure that proof of work? And the answer is by incentive. There are two incentives in the Bitcoin protocol. The first is that in new blocks, the miner, the person who solves that problem, gets coins basically not for free, but as part of the block printing process. The person who finds and mines the block gets Bitcoins as a reward. The second way that you get a reward is transaction fees. If anyone wants to submit a transaction to the Bitcoin network and get their transaction processed, just like the Visa network will charge a fee, the Bitcoin network also charges a fee. And that fee goes to the miner who solved the proof of work. The incentive structure is very important to give miners a reason to keep on mining and maintain the security of the network. But also, towards the end of the section, there's a really interesting, compelling point where should a miner or an attacker amass computational power that puts the network at risk, well, this incentive structure actually pushes them in the direction of being a legal, quote-unquote, or honest node in the network, as in they'll get more rewards by playing by the rules than they will by attacking it. So, for example, if I had enough computational power to attack the network and go back in time and change blocks, well, I might be able to double spend, but that would also put the network at risk and reduce the price of each Bitcoin because it has less value. Whereas I could just use that computational power and mine properly, legally, honestly on the network and earn those rewards. And so the incentive structure is there to make sure that even people who could be attacking the network are actually supporting it, which is ingenious. Seven, reclaiming disk space. Once the latest transaction in a coin is buried under enough blocks, the spent transactions before it can be discarded to save disk space. To facilitate this without breaking the block's hash, transactions are hashed in a Merkle tree, with only the root included in the block's hash. Old blocks can then be compacted by stubbing off branches of the tree. The interior hashes do not need to be stored. A block header with no transactions would be about 80 bytes. If we suppose blocks are generated every 10 minutes, 80 bytes times 6 times 24 times 365 equals 4.2 megabytes per year, with computer systems typically selling with 2 gigabytes of RAM as of 2008, and Moore's law predicting current growth of 1.2 gigabytes per year, storage should not be a problem, even if the block headers must be kept in memory. What Section 7 is discussing is the problem of keeping track, keeping the history of all of the transactions. If we said that the main point of the Bitcoin network is to be an open, public, distributed ledger, as in a track of all of the different transactions, well, you have to store that. And because it's distributed, ideally you can store that on your laptop. So the size of that ledger matters. Not everyone can store terabytes of information on their laptop. So there's a question of how do you save disk space? The way that the Bitcoin protocol deals with this issue is by using a data structure called a Merkle tree. I will leave a link in the resources to what a Merkle tree is, and there will also be a diagram of what a block actually looks like from the white paper. But what's important to know is that Merkle trees are a data structure that saves space and is verified cryptographically. So it's very efficient for this use case of the Bitcoin protocol. Eight, simplified payment verification. It is possible to verify payments without running a full network node. A user only needs to keep a copy of the block headers of the longest proof of work chain, which he can get by querying network nodes until he's convinced he has the longest chain, and obtain the Merkle branch linking the transaction to the block it's timestamped in. He can't check the transaction for himself, but by linking it to a place in the chain, he can see that a network node has accepted it, and blocks added after it further confirm the network has accepted it. As such, the verification is reliable as long as honest nodes control the network, but is more vulnerable if the network is overpowered by an attacker. While network nodes can verify transactions for themselves, the simplified method can be fooled by an attacker's fabricated transactions for as long as the attacker can continue to overpower the network. One strategy to protect against this would be to accept alerts from network nodes when they detect an invalid block, prompting the user's software to download the full block and alerted transactions to confirm the inconsistency. Businesses that receive frequent payments will probably still want to run their own nodes for more independent security and quicker verification. Section 8 comes to answer a question of how can someone verify the blockchain, the public open ledger, if they're not running the software? And the answer is simple and elegant. All you need to verify the validity of a previous transaction is to query the network and see that that transaction has been accepted as part of a valid block, and that that block has been accepted and is on the longest chain of blocks. The network always assumes that the longest chain of blocks is correct because that's the chain with the most CPU proof of work power behind it, so it's the most secure. And the elegant part of the solution is that you don't have to actually verify each individual unique transaction. Rather, you just have to verify the block that it was in. And if that block is valid, you can then go on and find that transaction if you want, but you can also assume that it's a valid transaction because it's in a valid block that the entire system has voted on and accepted. Nine, combining and splitting value. Although it would be possible to handle coins individually, it would be unwieldy to make a separate transaction for every cent in a transfer. To allow value to be split and combined, transactions contain multiple inputs and multiple outputs. Normally, there will be either a single input from a large previous transaction, or multiple inputs combining smaller amounts, and at most two outputs, one for the payment and one returning the change, if any, back to the sender. It should be noted that fan-out, where a transaction depends on several transactions, and those transactions depend on many more, is not a problem here. There is never the need to extract a complete standalone copy of a transaction's history. Section 9 deals with how transactions are actually computed. If you think about how a bank ledger is stored, a bank keeps track of the money in all of the accounts. When you want to transfer money, they will check your account balance, see if you have enough money, and then transfer it. The Bitcoin network works differently. It doesn't check if you have the balance. What happens as part of the transaction is that you'll send the money you want to send to someone else into the transaction. And that's how the network knows that you actually have enough money. It's not going and checking your balance. So for example, if Bob wanted to send Alice $10, Bob would put into the transaction, let's say $12, because he wants to send a fee for the miner who's securing the network. And the output of that transaction would be that $10 gets sent to Alice, let's say $1 gets sent to the miner, and $1 gets sent back to Bob. The verification of the amount that you want to send doesn't happen by checking a ledger like in a bank. It is actually built into the transaction. Ten, privacy. The traditional banking model achieves a level of privacy by limiting access to information to the parties involved and the trusted third party. The necessity to announce all transactions publicly precludes this method, but privacy can still be maintained by breaking the flow of information in another place, by keeping public keys anonymous. The public can see that someone is sending an amount to someone else, but without information linking the transaction to anyone. This is similar to the level of information released by stock exchanges, where the time and size of individual trades, the tape, quote-unquote, is made public, but without telling who the parties were. As an additional firewall, a new key pair should be used for each transaction to keep them from being linked to a common owner. Some linking is still unavoidable with multi-input transactions, which necessarily reveal that their inputs were owned by the same owner. The risk is that if the owner of a key is revealed, linking could reveal other transactions that belonged to the same owner. 11. Calculations. We consider the scenario of an attacker trying to generate an alternate chain faster than the honest chain. Even if this is accomplished, it does not throw the system open to arbitrary changes, such as creating value out of thin air, or taking money that never belonged to the attacker. Nodes are not going to accept an invalid transaction as payment, and honest nodes will never accept a block containing them. An attacker can only try to change one of his own transactions to take back money he recently spent. The race between the honest chain and an attacker chain can be characterized as a binomial random walk. The success event is the honest chain being extended by one block, increasing its lead by plus one, and the failure event is the attacker's chain being extended by one block, reducing the gap by minus one. The probability of an attacker catching up from a given deficit is analogous to a gambler's ruin problem. Suppose a gambler with unlimited credit starts at a deficit and plays potentially an infinite number of trials to try to reach break-even. We can calculate the probability he ever reaches break-even, or that an attacker ever catches up with the honest chain, as follows. And here there are some calculations, not very many, but I will skip them. And the main point is summarized in this sentence. Given our assumption that the probability of an honest node finding the next block is greater than the probability that the attacker finds the next block, the probability of an attack drops exponentially as the number of blocks the attacker has to catch up with increases. With the odds against him, if he doesn't make a lucky lunge forward early on, his chances become vanishingly small as he falls further behind. We now consider how long the recipient of a new transaction needs to wait before being sufficiently certain the sender can't change the transaction. We assume the sender is an attacker who wants to make the recipient believe he paid him for a while, then switch it to pay back to himself after some time has passed. The receiver will be alerted when that happens, but the sender hopes it will be too late. The receiver generates a new key pair and gives the public key to the sender shortly before signing. This prevents the sender from preparing a chain of blocks ahead of time by working on it continuously until he is lucky enough to get far enough ahead, then executing the transaction at that moment. Once the transaction is sent, the dishonest sender starts working in secret on a parallel chain containing an alternate version of his transaction. The recipient waits until the transaction has been added to a block and Z blocks have been linked after it. He doesn't know the exact amount of progress the attacker has made, but assuming the honest blocks took the average expected time per block, the attacker's potential progress will be a Poisson distribution with the expected value of Z, which is the number of blocks that have been linked after the block with a transaction, multiplied by the probability of the attacker finding a block, divided by the probability of the defender or the honest nodes finding the next block. The section that follows in the paper finds the right amount of blocks for the probability of 0.01, as in how many blocks would you have to wait for the probability of an attacker succeeding in reversing your transaction, and the number that comes out is 6 blocks. As in, if you wait 6 blocks, there is less than a 0.001 chance that an attacker will be able to double spend their money. 12. Conclusion. We have proposed a system for electronic transactions without relying on trust. We started with the usual framework of coins made from digital signatures, which provides strong control of ownership, but is incomplete without a way to prevent double spending. To solve this, we propose a peer-to-peer network using proof of work to record a public history of transactions that quickly become computationally impractical for an attacker to change if honest nodes control a majority of CPU power. The network is robust in its unstructured simplicity. Nodes work all at once with little coordination. They do not need to be identified since messages are not routed to any particular place and only need to be delivered on a best effort basis. Nodes can leave and rejoin the network at will, accepting the proof of work chain as proof of what happened while they were gone. They vote with their CPU power, expressing their acceptance of valid blocks by working on extending them, and rejecting invalid blocks by refusing to work on them. Any needed rules and incentives can be enforced with this consensus mechanism. And that is the end of the Bitcoin white paper. All in all, 8 pages, the 9th page only includes references, a very simple, elegant white paper that outlines the solution to a problem in the digital sphere of electronic cash that's been around for decades. You'll find the white paper itself in the lesson resources, as well as links to further materials that I highly recommend you go read. And while the core concepts of the white paper are simple and elegant, to really understand the interplay of the mechanisms involved, it might take a second reading or listening. I hope you enjoyed this reading of the Bitcoin white paper. Thanks for listening.